I just have to say, you are so spirited. I just want to put you in a box and saw you in half.
For magic. As a part of a trick. He does magic.
Right.
It's only weird if you don't embrace
Thank
it.
You.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
All right, thank you, Harrison, for doing this free podcast. I appreciate it.
Free? I thought there was millions of dollars in this. God damn it.
I brought you cupcakes. I don't know what you're talking about.
Thanks for that half-eaten box of cupcakes.
They were delicious, by the way. No, I get this is the first time we've recorded in a hotel room, and you offered me cupcakes, so thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, we have to thank Ben, my friend, and Ben and Cassie, who sent me the cupcakes.
Ben who?
A magician, Ben Nemzer, and Cassandra, also a magician.
I was going to say, I know another Ben, but I do not. That's nice of him. That's cool.
Yeah, it was sweet.
So we'll just jump right in. You did Conan last night. How's that feeling? How's that vibe going?
It was cool. It was one of those, like, you have that list of goals, and this year especially, I was like, I really want to do a late night set. Like, it feels like something that, like, I've been working really hard towards, and, like, I just really want to do it, and I committed to, like, that goal, and Friday afternoon, I got an email being like, can you fly out and be here and tape Tuesday?
That's insane.
Yeah.
That's like, yeah.
And I had like a couple of shows on the calendar. So like I found out Friday afternoon, and then between Friday afternoon and Friday night, I emailed everybody I knew at the show and was like, I need to just run 5 minutes. Can I run 5 minutes on your show? And everybody was like incredibly kind. Like it was really amazing how many people like squoze me in or, you know, figured out a way to just accommodate me. And I did, it was like 5 shows Friday, 5 shows Saturday, 7 Sunday, and then 4 in LA, which like is physically should be impossible. But because everybody was so kind, I was able to map it out literally and do 4 shows, just boom, 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 boom.
Just the same material over
running
and over.
That set over and over wow. and over again.
Yeah, because that's what they, I mean, you hear comedians who like talk about their first Tonight Show set. Like that's what they do. They just run that 5 minutes over and over. And is this newer material for you, or is it stuff that you've had around for a while?
It's stuff that I've had around. I definitely didn't want to. There's this weird thing where sometimes I get really excited about a bit, and then sometimes it takes a year of being in my act before I'm like, oh, now I've really found the heart of it. And so I wanted to do bits that I was really happy with and felt like they had reached their potential.
Sure, sure. So how did you feel it went? Because I watched it last night, thought it was hilarious, thought it got
it
a great
cool.
response. Did you really get standing ovations at the beginning and end?
Yeah.
Because
they didn't
show it. So I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. That's
yeah,
the
it was so
thing.
Weird. I feel like I look slightly crazy in that I'm like thanking the audience for a standing ovation.
Not that I'm accusing you of making
no,
that
course.
Up, but they didn't cut to it. So it was like,
I know.
And I watch Conan all the time and I've never
They never
seen
cut to
that.
The audience.
Well, I don't think that happens very often. So that's
yeah.
really cool.
I asked the booker about it and he said, yeah, it's pretty rare. So it was cool. Standing ovation at the beginning threw me. Because I was like, they don't know who I am. Although I found out later, there was a couple of people who had seen me on AGT, so there were a couple of fans with the
okay.
audience. But yeah, at the end, when they stood up, I was just like, cool. Like, I guess I did it. I guess I did the job.
Score.
Yeah.
Nice. And Conan was cool. And
Conan was
and
great.
Awesome. You got your cue cards here, I saw.
Yeah. I've seen a couple other comics with their cue cards, like, framed on their wall, so I was always very jealous. So that was, like, as soon as the set was over, I was like, is it cool if I take these? And they were going to throw them out anyway.
Yeah,
so
what
like,
are they
going to
do with
these
them?
Things.
They can't use them. I mean, it has that nice handwriting, too.
That cue card writing.
Yeah, that you see on SNL and stuff.
And it's just a guy.
It's like, just one dude, yeah.
It's a dude who just knows how to do that.
Yeah, and, like, you would think they would switch over to digital, but I think because of last-minute changes and it's probably easier to read.
Yeah, I wonder why they can't have a giant printer, though. It seems like that would have been the next step.
Yeah, but it's just one of those cool, like, old-school TV things that's, I think, grandfathered in of, yeah, we'll
have
a guy. We got Steve. He's been here for 60 years. It's been great. So where do you go from here? What's after? Are you going back to New York?
Flying out to New York tomorrow morning, very, very early. And doing, I have a show Thursday night in New York, then 3 Friday, 3 Saturday. So just like right back to the grind.
Jeez.
And now working on the next set. You know, so just trying to figure out, obviously that would be really weird if I did the set and then I immediately email back. All right. You want me again next week?
Sure.
But yeah, definitely working with a mind towards, you know, the next one and, mm-hmm. and just hammering out new material.
That's wild. And before this, you were on tour with our good buddy Brett Loudermilk and a bunch of other LA friends who also do Booby Trap and whatnot here in Australia. What was that like?
It was amazing. So I started off with The Illusionist. So The Works is the company that produces The Illusionist.
Okay.
So they sent me out for like 3.5 weeks to do The Illusionist in Perth, Australia. And that was incredibly fun. Like Raymond Crowe was on the show and Kevin
He's
James.
He's amazing,
and
yeah.
Colin Cloud was on there and, mm-hmm. and James, just like everybody was so fun. James, Colin, and I had like a blast. We all did. It was just Jonathan Good. Like everybody there was just so fun. So it really felt like it was one of those gigs where you're just like, it's kind of fun too. And you're like, this is why I'm doing it because it's so fun. And then I got the call a few months later where they're like, we're trying to try this thing where it's more of a variety show. So the Illusionist model, but with variety performers. Instead of seven magicians, we'll have a juggler and a fire eater and a ventriloquist and a magician. Mm-hmm. And that was really exciting because it meant I could sort of shine on the stand-up side.
Sure.
So I had a lot more freedom to do that stuff. And so it was like, yeah, 2 months. Sydney Opera House for 21 shows.
Jeez.
The Melbourne Arts Centre was like a 2,000 or 3,000 seat theater. We did, I think, 20 shows there.
Mm-hmm.
And then back to Perth. So I ended up all the way back full circle to the theater where I started with The Works.
Mm-hmm.
We did 20 shows there too.
How do you adjust what you're doing from like the Comedy Store to the Sydney Opera House?
It's the audience is definitely very different. Acoustically, the Sydney Opera House is weird for comedy.
I would think so.
Because the thing that makes it such a beautiful building is its height and that sort of winginess of it. It has that sort of curve to it. I'm like drawing in the air like anybody can see what I'm doing with my finger.
I can see it.
I think people will know the Sydney Opera House. But you're inside of the biggest sort of wing. And that acoustically means all your sound's going up. And for a large orchestra, it's great. But for laughter, I want that coming directly at my head. So you have to get used to it a little bit that it's acoustically not going to sound like a comedy club.
Sure.
And there's kids and there's tourists and it's just a different mix of people.
Mm-hmm.
And my job as the host is to make sure everybody looks really good. So it's a lot of writing material that like can transition easily in and out of whatever the next act is.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the end of the tour, like, we started off with a head mic and I ended up holding a handheld mic.
Nice.
Because I was like, everyone else had a thing that made them look like the thing that they were. Like, if you're a sword swallower, you have a sword in your hand, people immediately know this guy's going to swallow swords.
Yeah.
So I had the microphone. I was getting to do real stand-up, and it felt really cool. It just mm-hmm. a little bit slower. That was the main thing, is it takes a second between my accent and the size of the venue for that joke to get all the way to the back of the house and then come back forwards.
Mm-hmm. Even with the holding a mic, there's just some different dichotomy there as opposed to having a headset, because I go back and forth with it all the time in my shows, and I love to hold the mic, and I love it. Just gives you that sense of being in a single place and just planting yourself on stage.
It's also it's a tool. Like do pure stand-up, which is most of my shows are pure stand-up, that's our only tool, is that microphone. So we get really good at like moving it away. Like, even in the Conan set, I pulled it away to do that thing where I'm having that conversation with I'm like holding the guy in like a stranglehold.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, what are you doing? And I pull the mic away. And so I get this auditory effect.
Sure.
Which, when you have the handheld mic, the mic on your face is going to be that same distance. So you lose a whole range of like sound effects and things that you can do. Or even for me, I do like a rant at the end where I scream.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to save my voice, I usually will just basically bring the microphone really, really close. Which I guess if you're listening now, maybe this is happening. I don't know what the microphone does.
Just went way the hell up.
Okay.
That was good. It sounded funny.
So you bring the microphone real close and then you talk at basically the same volume that I normally talk, but because the mic is closer, it's louder.
Yeah.
And I basically look like I'm screaming because like my veins are popping out, but I'm not pushing it so hard that I'm going to do damage. So I can scream every show.
Mm-hmm. This is very specific questions, but stuff I'm fascinated because it's what I struggle with is, when you're doing magic and holding a mic, how do you balance that? Because when I'm doing it, I'm just physically freaking out because I don't know where to put my hands. I don't know, like, I gotta like grab this, I gotta grab that. And
I mean, it's a lot of microphone stand work. Yeah. Like the default position, if I'm doing the actual, my show, like when I do my full like 75-minute show, I'm sort of alternating between stand-up and magic. When I do the stand-up parts, I usually can take the mic out of the stand and just do full, like, sort of stand-up-y, just hold the microphone and perform. But once I get into a magic effect, usually it's got to go back in the stand, and then you kind of wrap your hands around it. But you could even use your feet a little bit, because it's on the, like, I get the weighted stand. You can lean with the microphone even while it's in the stand. So as long as one hand is on the stand, you have full sort of motion with it.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing obviously would be, you know, I definitely know of magicians who have made mistakes where they forget that the microphone stand is metal and their hands are wrapped around it. So if your magic trick involves some kind of magnet, you want to be careful that your props don't get attached to the stand. That's the one sort of danger, is you have this giant metal rod in the middle of
I've done that before. Yeah.
I was workshopping a trick that is not in the show where I had a magnety kind of thing in my pocket. And it was one of the shows where it was like a workout show. And like, it's like, let me try this new piece in the middle. But while I was doing the first trick, that thing just kept, my pocket kept getting stuck to the the stand. And I was like, this has to be totally rejiggered.
What's wrong with him? Why is that going on?
Yeah, I was partially thankful that trick didn't make it in my act, because I was like, where am I going to put this prop in a way that I don't have to ever worry throughout 75 minutes I'm going to get stuck to the microphone stand.
It's funny how, there's things you try out and you're like, this is going to be great. This is killer. And then it's one little issue like that where when you screw it up, or if it screws up on stage, you're like, oh good, I get to take this out. I don't have to do this anymore.
Yeah, and then Amazing Jonathan has that great gag where he's doing the rope and he goes, an ordinary rope, and then it magnets to the stand and then he fights it off. And I would put money on it that was, he meant to do it seriously one time doing a trick. He got stuck on the microphone stand. He's like, that's way funnier than any trick I could do with that rope.
Because I've seen that happen to so many other magicians where they're like, and they grab it. And all the magicians in the audience chuckle to themselves. So just backtracking a little bit. So magic came first, obviously. Then did you transition into stand-up, or has it always been a combo? Because I do very little research on this show. So
no, that's cool. The very like Cliff Notes version of my life story was that I started magic as a kid, like 5 years old. Like Hanukkah gift was like a magic set, the whole nine. Went to magic camp where I'm still like a counselor. Mm-hmm. Which totally changed my life. And I'm still in contact with a ton of the people from camp, and they're like a second family. And then in college, I was in a fraternity, actually AAPI, which is the fraternity that's like responsible for Facebook, which I guess for better or for worse now at this point. So you're sorry. I'm sorry. And you're welcome.
Thanks. Are you part of the Winklevoss twin?
Oh, no, they were in the final club. Okay. Mark Zuckerberg was the AAPI guy. And then all of his roommates and stuff and fraternity brothers were the core of the... of Facebook.
Oh, that's legit.
And they were ahead of us. They were seniors while I was a freshman.
Okay.
Mark was the only one who actually wasn't on campus. Everybody else was still a senior, and he had already left after junior year to be the head of Facebook.
Gotcha.
But one of the frat brothers was like, hey, we do this yearly comedy show. Do you want to do magic on it? And I was like, can I do stand-up on it? Like, why not? Why not try it? So I did sort of a bunch of stand-up and then close with a magic trick. And I remember just having a blast, because all these rules that I had in magic, like you had to dress up. I was always wearing like khakis and a blazer. I never cursed at all on stage. I was always very, very clean. There was always a magic trick to do. It wasn't just about the joke. After all those rules like kind of came crashing down in that set, I was like, oh, this is really, really fun. I kind of want to keep pursuing this. Then freshman year, I didn't know what I was going to do for like, everyone was doing fancy internships. So I was like, what am I going to do? So I randomly found out that Mad Magazine was having an internship. And I got it, and I was like, this is perfect. So I spent 6 weeks learning comedy writing from, like, the usual gang of idiots. And then doing open mics. And that at that point, like, I'd been completely, like, taken over by, like, a love of doing stand-up and the rush of just doing jokes and that kind of thing. And then after a few years of being in the city, I was always still doing magic here and there. But then there was this, like, Broadway Danny Rose type guy named Marty. And he was like, you do magic. You should do a magic trick in your set. And so I would close with this baby trick, which has become like a signature piece of mine. I had to take it out of the act because I realized because I knew that thing would do really well. You need that fight or flight response when you're doing magic. Like when doing stand up, like you need to know that there's nothing else to help you. So I became very bifurcated with like just stand up gigs and just sort of no magic in those gigs. And then I just started slowly putting together this show where I was trying to combine it. And because I feel like a lot of comedy magic is really just magic that has like sort of stock jokes or jokes based on the trick itself. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what is if I took like real stand up, like from my act, and really that sort of basically create comedy magic, but with the rules of real stand up. So it's everything's original. Everything is from my point of view. Everything is like strongly entrenched in my character, all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I built this like sort of hybrid that like I guess is like stand-up comedy magic, which it's been really fun to do because like there's some people who are like, man, that was so funny. And then I like was like, oh shit, the magic happened. And there's some people who come because they're magic fans and are like, we laugh the whole time. Like, because I'm doing a stand-up rhythm. It's a laugh every 10, 20 seconds. So it's just really fun to have like comedy and magic fans come and both of them getting sort of new things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean that sounds exactly what you know Steve Martin did. He just like realized one day he had to get rid of all the stock lines and get rid of all the standard stuff because he was passionate about, that stand-up angle, that comedy angle. And it sounds like it's been, you know, working out for you, which is good.
Yeah, and it's tough because magic, it's still, like, in comedy, there's sort of enforcement of that creativity. Like, people, because all you have is jokes, it's really important. And comics, if they hear somebody else do a joke, they stay away from it. Like, Jim Gaffigan has a Hot Pockets joke. Like, you'd have to be insane as a comedian to write another Hot Pockets joke. Even if it's a different Hot Pockets joke, like, Gaffigan's done it.
Exactly.
But in magic, it's the opposite. Like, there's a magic equivalent of the Hot Pockets, whatever trick it is, color match or whatever popular trick of the moment. Somebody sees it, it kills, and then every other magician goes, oh, I should do that. So it's the exact opposite. So that can be a little bit frustrating because, like, I'll work really, really hard on a line or a joke for my act, and then, like, I get much more worried about magicians taking it than comedians.
I think that's a legit thing. I mean, I just went through that today with my cruise agent. We got a thing back from one of the ships I do, and they're like, we love you. This is great. It's going well. The only critique, if this could be a critique, is that you're doing some of the stuff is older magic, and which is totally valid and totally true, but I'm like, all the routines are my own. And so I'm struggling with, all right, do I just completely get rid of all the old magic and just work on new stuff? Because they're clearly not seeing that the routines are my own. So it's right. I'm in this interesting spot right now.
I mean, I think there's like a magic way of looking at things and a comedian way of looking at things. The magic way of looking at, like, the linking rings is, oh, I have my own routine of the linking rings. The comedian's way is, you're all doing linking rings.
Exactly.
There's only so much you can do. Like, when I give a lecture called You Are All Terrible, which is based on my genie thing. And one of the reasons...
Did you do this on Penguin?
I haven't recorded it for anywhere yet.
Oh, okay.
I had an offer to record it. Actually, a couple offers to record it. And I turned them all down, temporarily at least, because I was like, I approached it the same way I approached my stand-up. I was like, I want to run this lecture over and over again. Because I try to... It's kind of a performance. Like, there's a PowerPoint and I'm making jokes. So every time I do it, it gets funnier and tighter. And I'm like, I don't want to commit it until it's as tight as, like this late night set. I want to run it a million times. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I talk about is the iPhone theory of magic, which is magicians have this tendency to, like, buy an iPhone. Everybody has the same iPhone. Everybody has that same trick. And they put a new case on it. Like, mine's red. Yours is blue. So we have different iPhones. But they're still iPhones. Like, everyone should be building completely different stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is really important. Like, is just coming up with ideas that feel you and then figuring out how do you make them magic or put the magic in them. Mm-hmm. Like, most of my tricks come from, like, really weird ideas or silly ideas of, like, wouldn't it be cool if I could do this? And I sort of write the script before I even know how or what the effect is.
Sure.
So I'm like, oh, I want, like, my FU card trick. Can we curse on this thing?
Oh, we can. Okay. On the internet.
So the fuck you card trick.
All three people that listen to this.
Yeah. So I developed this thing called the fuck you card trick. And there was a little kerfuffle about it with the illusionist released the fuck you card trick. And I was like, hey, that's kind of a routine I've been doing for years.
I've never seen this. Yeah, this was recently.
This was recent. And then I was in Australia, so everything was time shifted. So, like, trying to call them and getting all this, waking up in the middle of the night and having my phone be exploded from other magicians and stuff. But to their credit, I sent them the video, like, from years and years ago of this trick. They were like, oh, shit, this is definitely your trick. As they sent out an apology thing and they pulled the trick.
I saw that. Yeah, that was great.
That was cool.
Yeah.
But that trick I didn't have a method for the trick until the trick had already been written and created. Like, I was like, it would be so funny to hand somebody, be like, think of any card, and then the card says fuck you on it, but then you peel off this, like, sticker. That was the original idea, is it's a sticker and you peel it off, and underneath that fuck you sticker is the card that they named. So I had all these beats for it and I had all this stuff. And then I was like, oh, I need a method for this. Like, I'm not a wizard. So how do you do that? And then that's the basic thesis of the You Are All Terrible lecture is that that's how artists create, is they go from idea, then they figure out what technique to use. And most magicians buy a technique and then they figure out what the idea is. Mm-hmm. And it's much easier to be original if you come up with the idea first. Because once you're holding the prop, once you're holding linking rings, there's only so far away you can get from it. Mm-hmm. You're like, okay, now my rings are smaller. Now the rings are hula hoops. Now the rings are earring hula.
Yeah.
Now the music is jazz versus rap or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's only so much you can do. It's still linking rings.
I want to see a linking rings done to rap music.
I feel like there was an Australian guy who did a rap. Oh no, it was the 6-card repeat rap. Timelis had that. He, like, did it at FISM or something.
Okay.
And by the way, I realized I started talking about linking rings. I was like, I don't know if Nick does it. It would be so awful if like, you're like, that's my signature effect.
This
and
great linking ring. No, I do multiplying bottles, which is my version of linking rings.
But multiplying bottles is so tough to like do. I don't know how to. I don't think I've ever seen an original version of it because it's everyone is very similar to everyone else's. Mm-hmm. So that one's a toughie.
I hope mine is, but I don't know. I'm sure somebody watches and goes, he's doing so and so, but. I totally agree with you. It's so hard to trans. If you're in a state, if you started in a state of I'm buying the trick, then I'm going to create the routine, as opposed to create the routine, then figure out the method/trick.
And you can still buy tricks. Like once in a while, I buy a trick. So I'm like, I should have this in my closet.
Totally.
Because I feel like there could be something there.
Yeah.
It's like there's a price range. It's a price range, and it's big enough for parlor. Like it packs small. Plays big and is within a certain price range, mm-hmm. and every magician will buy it. Like, because they're like, oh, this, I can put this right, I can plug this right into the act. And if it's going in right away, like if it's going in and right away it's killing, the things that are killing are not yours.
Exactly.
Like, the things that are killing are like, that's the danger with magic is it, you could buy a trick and put in your show and the audience will go crazy.
Yeah.
But none, they're not going crazy for anything that you did.
Yeah. And that's certainly the struggle a lot of the times is if you walk off stage and kill, it's like, okay, did I kill or did John so-and-so's trick kill that I just happened to be, you know, wearing the clothes of? Yeah.
Especially comedy magic where like you can buy tricks that have like built-in sort of laugh mm-hmm. moments and you're like, that I will always stay away from. Like mm-hmm. that's the section, like on a magic website when it lists like comedy magic, that's the section I will stay the farthest away from if I need to purchase something. Like,
totally.
Definitely don't want to buy anything that has comedy magic in the title already. Like mm-hmm. that's definitely not for me. When comedians like ask me, like when I try to explain magic to comedians, the Vanishing Bandana is like the best example. Because when you tell a comedian that there's a trick that you can buy where you literally are just like miming actions mm-hmm. while a CD plays filled with jokes that you didn't write, that you didn't perform.
You paid $25 just hitting dollars for
it. Yeah, it was $25 and the jokes are being performed by a CD and you just have to literally follow the instructions mm-hmm. that come with the package. It like blows their mind because not only are you not doing your own jokes, but like somebody is saying those jokes for you on mm-hmm. a CD that you're then playing. And I think the audience also, like, the audience thinks you recorded it or had some hand in it.
Yeah,
that's like the example I always use is it's like a lot of magicians are Beatles cover bands that think they're John Lennon.
Oh yeah, wow, that's perfect.
And that trick is the ultimate where, like, mm-hmm. you're literally playing a CD.
See, I thought I was so cool. I re-recorded it in my voice, and I changed some of the lines, but not enough to make it my own. Still, like, any other person would see somebody else's routine, and this is years ago, and like I said, it's coming out, even out of the workshop now. I mean, I took it out of the show years ago, but it's like...
But structurally, like, you can learn from the structure of it. Like, the idea of having a...
If you buy it purely as a learning exercise, I think it's great.
And if they're like kid magicians listening, that's the other thing where it's like, mm-hmm. when we were 13, we all were doing whatever your favorite magician was, you were, even if you were unconsciously, you were miming that person because you were mm-hmm. a 13-year-old kid. So like, I definitely get that it's part of like being a kid in magic is sometimes watching the DVD and being a tiny Michael Lamar or whoever. But like, once you decide to be a pro and like become like an adult performer, then you really have to get rid of all of that stuff. And that can be hard.
Yeah. It's tough. Yeah. I mean, I still slip into Jeff Hobson sometimes when I'm doing my talking stuff and not doing my physical stuff. And it's like, oh, I gotta stop. That was okay when I was 18. Right.
Although that's such a weird character. Like, how does that, are you doing any of like the gay stuff?
No, just in terms of, I don't know, in terms of just the excitement, in terms of like the way you're reacting to things and calling stuff out. Maybe it's not even so much Jeff Hobson anymore, but my mentor was taught by him and I've interviewed him, chatted with him a bit. He's a super nice guy. And so I think it's stuff like that has just still been ingrained in my DNA in some way. But I think it's good to have your influences, but you definitely, if you can't find your voice and find who you are on stage, then I don't know if you should be doing it.
Right.
I don't know if you should be doing pursuing stuff that is outside of, I don't know, smaller events. And that's not to be, I mean, we've talked about this a lot in the podcast, and it's not to be judgmental, and everybody has their spot and can do their own thing.
Oh, but you don't have to be, but I am judging. I am a very strong fan of judging.
Harrison's the judgmental one here.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
If you're calling yourself a professional magician and you're not doing your own stuff, then you need to literally like ask yourself, what are you doing with your life?
Totally.
Like that's why I called the thing you are all terrible, because I do think there is a tremendous problem in magic that I only really realized once I got into the comedy world, I was like, oh, everybody here's an actual artist.
Yeah.
They come up with an idea and they express this thing that's very important to them. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to express a thing that's important to you through somebody else's trick. Like, you have to come and you have to express a real thing. Like, there's so many tricks that don't really express ideas because they were just purchased and then performed. Mm. And like, if you're going to dedicate, it's hard enough to be a professional magician, and it's definitely not an easy way to make a living. It can be fun, but if you're going to give up your life and sacrifice your life to be a magician, then like, shouldn't you be an artist then? Like, mm-hmm. shouldn't you at least know that you're contributing to the art form and doing it the right way?
Yeah. I mean, I had a guy email me, for the second time within 4 years, claiming I ripped off a trick of his. And it's one of my few original routines. And I was like, dude, I came up with this in my apartment on my own. And I was inspired by X, Y, and Z, but I didn't rip off your trick. And it's right. so funny. It's like, I ripped off that guy's trick, but I ripped off this trick. No, I didn't. But, you know, it's funny. Like, when you just, you work on something, you claim ownership of it because you've put so much time and effort, like you were saying, years into it. And somebody claims you just walked away with it. It's just
and amazing. Then also, and the more, like, there's a Ken Weber quote in Maximum Entertainment.
That's a great book.
And I believe he's paraphrasing Bob Cassidy. And I'm going to screw up both of their quotes. That's but the idea of the quote was, the hardest thing is the easiest thing, which is, like, it's really, really hard to be original and to do the actual, like, work. But then it makes everything else easy in the sense that, like, once it's in your voice, it's hard for some, like, once somebody tries to steal something that's original and clearly yours, it's very obvious that they did that. So you get that sort of protection because mm-hmm. everybody would know that they're doing a Harrison Greenbaum joke or whoever it is. Mm-hmm. And also for, like, booking and stuff, like, if you're doing your own original stuff, you're the only one they can hire to do that thing.
Yeah.
So all of these hard things become easy by doing the hard thing, which is being mm-hmm. an artist.
Well, it's funny. Yeah. I mean, going back to what I was saying about my cruise ship thing, you see, you know Marcus Monroe?
Yeah, I love Marcus.
I worked with him on a ship 2 weeks ago, and I was actually talking about this on last week's episode, but I'm watching him on stage, and he's doing, like, alt comedy in a mainstream touristy audience.
100%.
And it's working. And I told him this after the show. I'm like, this shouldn't be working, but it's working for this crowd, and it's killing, and I'm so happy for you, and it's so pleasant to see. So I think there is, like, this cultural shift, even in mainstream touristy audiences, and, like, I'm not shaming them. I'm just, that's what it is. You go on a cruise ship, those are your audience. They're people from middle America that don't see a lot of live entertainment. And, or if they do, it's, you know, Big Bang Theory. Nothing wrong with that. But, you know, it's not alt comedy. And there is this weird shift of people kind of craving original stuff, original points of view.
And people are smarter now. Like,
a lot smarter, yeah.
I think in the old days, if you were doing a bunch of routines that are stock, it was very hard for somebody to figure out where those tricks came from. But now people have the internet. So, like, there's a lot more stuff on the internet from Fool Us and AGT. And a lot of these routines are already out there. It's easy to Google routines or Google, like, the words associated with the routine, like balls. Like, he had a bunch of balls and there was more balls. And, like, Google will eventually send them to the trick. So you can see 17 different magicians performing the same trick. And I think that the average person, when they see that, it really takes them out of that illusion. They're like, wait, why are there 17 guys doing this? Like, if you type in Vanishing Bandana, you can see a bazillion guys doing it. Mm-hmm. And that's got to be really weird because, like, you can't do that with comedy.
Yeah. Yeah. And if there are two routines slightly similar, somebody on YouTube will compare them or put them split screen and the internet will go crazy.
And there is, like, parallel development. Like, there's definitely... Yeah. Like, there are going to be people who come up with a Trump joke and somebody on the other side of the country will come up with the exact same Trump joke.
Yeah, it's not that hard.
Because it's a Trump joke. You know, like, I always say, like, my test for figuring out, like, if somebody says they didn't steal material, you always have to be like, how did you develop the bit? Because everybody who writes or creates a bit can tell you exactly why they wrote the bit, mm-hmm. where they were when they came up with the bit, the big problems they had as they developed the bit. Like, you can literally pull any trick from my show and I can be like, oh, the reason I do this line is because of this. And there was a show in Indiana where I actually added this little half a line here. Mm-hmm. And you could literally just pinpoint everything. And there's always that story.
Yeah.
And that's a really quick test for being like, is it parallel development or is it theft? You're like, if he has a story, then it's probably just parallel development. If he doesn't have a story, then he probably, it was highly influenced by you, if we're being generous.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Where do you, oh, I just had your cripes, this always happens to me. You brain fart. Okay, moving on. I had a wonderful segue into what you're just talking about. It'll come back to me. We always ask people best gig experience, worst gig experience. You've been doing this a while. Do you have any like worst gig experiences that kind of stand out? And because you just did the Sydney Opera House, you just did Conan.
And I wore the same shoes on both. I was like, it was so funny because I don't think my shoes were clean the entire time I was in Australia. And part of me wanted, when they were like, oh, we can shine your shoes, I almost wanted to be like, it still has sort of like the dust of Sydney Opera House on them. I was like, no, it's going to be on TV. Let's just shine them. But yeah, for me, I toured with Jay Johnson, who I actually just had lunch with.
He's amazing.
He's unbelievable, mm-hmm. Which is, by the way, I say the word unbelievable a lot. And so when I got booked for a show called The Unbelievables, I'm like, I'm going to run into a serious issue on this tour where I'm just like, what do you think of the ventriloquist? I'm like, he's unbelievable. And then we're like, oh, God. He's using the name of it, the show again. So I had to like come up with all the, he's spectacular. but he really is unbelievable. And he has like, in the dressing room, he'd have his little like little tokens or whatever, things that are like ritualistically good luck. And I'm so against superstition, but like I do think that there's something really charming about in the entertainment industry having your little rituals. And I need them for like what I do before I go on stage and all that stuff. And it really like centers your brain. And so like something like that for me, like the reason I wore those shoes on Conan was it was partially good luck and partially just that like little extra boost of, I knew I could kind of like curl my toes in right before I walked out and be like, you did the Sydney Opera House with these shoes. I think you can handle Conan.
Oh, that's
so it was a way to fight the nerves on it.
Yeah, that's great. Jay's amazing. My dad's a ventriloquist, so I grew up.
Oh, that's amazing.
Going to like,
I didn't know that about
conventions.
You.
Yeah, and he would always come through, and you know, he's just like the celebrity among. I mean, he is a celebrity in general, but especially among ventriloquists.
Oh yeah,
he would just walk in, but he's the sweetest guy, and his show is just, talk about original material.
Oh my God,
it's hard to do original vent material, let alone magic. And he's, you know, his Broadway show, the Two and Only.
Two and Only. I watched it online because there's this Broadway HD, which is like Netflix but for Broadway shows. And I'm watching it, and I just toured with Jay for 2 months, and I finally got to see the whole thing just straight through. And I was like crying at the end. And so I literally sent him an angry message being like, fuck you for making me cry alone in my apartment at like 2 o'clock in the morning. Like, how dare you be that moving with this show?
With a monkey.
With a monkey. Oh. And that's a killer show. That thing is, man, that's like, that's the goal for it. I think any performers have a show that solid, that all the peaks and valleys of it's dramatic, it's funny, it's moving, it's silly, it's just all the things. Plus, he's technically killing it. The whole, like, every vent bit and all the different kinds of puppets. And it's so flawless. It's like that Italian word, sprezzatura. Sprezzatura?
Oh, I've never heard that before.
I know how it's spelled. I'm not sure how to pronounce it in Italian, but it's like sprezzatura, I believe. Sprezzatura. And it's like an Italian term for, it's like Schadenfreude. It's like a word that doesn't exist in English. It's for, like, the sort of just, like, almost like polish that comes from being a professional where like you're so good at it. It just like feels like it's happening naturally, but it's not because you're good at the thing. So it's like, he has that sprezzatura of like, it looks so effortless.
Sure.
But it's just because he's so good. What he's doing is still really hard.
I see that in guys like Reggie Watts. I see that in what you're doing. I see that in a lot of guys who, you know, it's, I think we were talking about this earlier of just getting to that level of where it looks easy, but it's actually a lot of work and years and years of blood and sweat.
And comedy is really frustrating with that because when you do magic effortlessly, the lay audience doesn't sit there and go, I can do that. Cause they're like, they definitely can't make a tiger appear. They know that they don't have a tiger. They don't have that box. They don't have any of those things. But when you do a really killer joke and you make it just seem like you're talking to the audience, which you're definitely not, you've been working on, like, it's that sprezzatura thing. But like, I do think there's some of these people in the audience who are like, oh, that looks so easy. I could do that. And you're like, no. That's the fact that you feel that means I've succeeded. And it's the opposite of what you should be feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a weird balance because people will either come into you after and talk to you, at least in my experience on like ships and stuff, they'll talk to you as if you're like this celebrity, you know, this life-changing celebrity, or they'll talk to you as, oh, that was cute.
Right. But you might be the only live entertainer they've ever met, like gotten to talk to. So that's pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're literally doing the same exact material, but you're kind of, at least in my case, I'm riding that line of making it look easier, making it look, or just being in those moments on stage where you're just really connecting with people and you know, all your training and work just shows up at the right moment. I think.
Or that, like, flow. Like, I was a psych major, so, like, hitting that level of flow where you're just, like, in the zone. See, Marty even had that in his autobiography of, like, he knew he was in the zone when his brain was, like, in the future, but his mouth was in the present.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
And that really, I have felt that recently where I'm, like, on stage and, like, I'm talking to somebody in the audience and I've gamed out the next four moves. Wow. So, like, that guy doesn't even know that I've already finished the joke. And so now I'm just walking him to that big punchline. And that's, like, the craziest feeling where you're like, oh, I'm in the future. I just have to catch everybody else up. But I know where this game is. I know where this is going.
You've played the chess match.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that's just obviously through just flight time and being on stage, but do you think that comes from learning to use a different part of your brain, like the improv part of your brain? Or do you think that's just something that happens in the moment and you're just grasping onto it?
It's just the sheer numbers of doing those things so many times and having so many variations in my head that as soon as they get close to something that there's like all these different pathways it can go. And as soon as they get somewhat close to one of the pathways, that's where I'm going to pounce and take it down that line. So there's like, they're basically these sort of games of like, okay, like this one guy said, I forgot how he mispronounced a word. So like, instead of saying Germany, he said Germany or something like that. And so I like pounced on that. And so for the rest of the show, the game in my head was, how can you mispronounce things in funny ways, like in reference to him? So once you realize like that's a kind of structural game, then you just let your brain loose and have fun with it. And then there'll be moments where I knew I was getting to a word. I knew it could be funnily mispronounced. So getting to that position where I can get it in there. So it seems like I'm coming up with it really fast, but like I've gamed that out 10 minutes ago in the show, in my head.
Interesting. Do you think that having a majoring in psychology has been super helpful in entertainment?
I don't know if it's helpful in entertainment. It's definitely useful.
Does it like force you to like be more introspective and more critical or less critical?
I mean, I did my thesis on comedy, so I definitely like studied it like specifically. But like on stage, it's more, I think it's more useful for magic because magic is so much about directing attention. Like when I'm coming up with a method for a trick, my psych background is super, super useful. Like figuring out how do I stage this? How do I do this? Because I don't want it to just fool them going forwards, like as the trick is happening and then it happens and they don't know. I want their memory of it to only make the mystery deeper. So it's putting those signposts that can fool them forwards and backwards. That's definitely all psych degree stuff. And in comedy, it's just, you know, it's that simple algorithm of just like you do the joke, you analyze the audience really honestly, and then you let that guide where the joke goes and you just do it 1,000 times. And the jokes that come out of that algorithm get funnier and funnier and funnier, or they get out of the act.
Mm-hmm. Jumping back to Conan and the Sydney stuff, for me, like I'm bringing it back to myself just to kind of center it, but anytime I do something bigger, like a bigger gig or something that you've really worked for and you get it, the second that's done, that kind of messes with me a little bit. Does that happen to you or are you just focusing on the next thing?
Definitely the next thing. Like, it was funny. One of my best friends texted me and was like, hey, you did great on Conan. Now you can be happy. And I'm like, yes, for 5 minutes. But now anger and sadness again.
Yeah.
Because like the 5 minutes you're on stage filming that set, it's like the biggest high. You're like, this is working and the audience is loving it and Conan is laughing and I'm staying all the jokes the right way and I feel cool. Like I feel it like in the moment with the audience. Yeah. And then as soon as it's done, you're like, oh shit. Yeah. What's the next exciting thing? But also like prepping for that set was so much work and so much running the same jokes over and over and over again. I also was like, I cannot wait for the next show when I don't have to do those jokes, when I can work on the next new jokes.
Sure.
Cause like even on the plane right here, I was listening to the most recent sets. Because I'm working on a new joke that has a lot of parts to it. So I was listening to the recordings of that joke on the plane right here and like writing out all of my fixes and stuff for that joke. And so there was this sort of under level of excitement that I was like, as soon as that set is done and taped, now I can actually go to the clubs and work on this new thing that I've been working on for the last couple of days on the plane. Like, so there's always that excitement. That's the thing that excites me the most is like fighting with that new bit.
Mm-hmm.
That's always when I have something new that I'm working on, I'm like the happiest and it's working. That's like my happiest moment.
How often are you writing new material?
Every day.
Yeah.
But it doesn't always work. So you're like, you come up with an idea and like, let me try it. And the audience is like, nope. And you're like, cool. So there's like this excitement though when you finally like it, you start to say the joke and the audience is really connecting with it. And you're like, oh, I finally hit that vein again. And I can, and then you get to just the fun structural thing. I love getting into the woods. Like with this bit right now, I'm so into the woods of like saying a word differently and like coming up with, I mean, literally, I'm going word by word now in the joke and moving little things around. It's like beautiful minding the joke. And that's so fun. But I don't want to invest that time until the audience has already told me with the sort of rough version of the joke that it's funny and worth dedicating that time.
Mm-hmm.
So once I get to be in that pocket where I'm like, I think the audience really likes this. I'm going to dedicate. Like the lightning joke I did on Conan was at least 10 months before it got to the shape where it was pretty consistently the same.
I actually just found out that the world record for most times being hit by lightning and surviving is 7. Did you guys know that? A dude was hit by and survived lightning 7 times. His name was Roy Sullivan. He's born in Virginia, 1912. He was an American. Hell yeah. Because we're like 36th in math and 24th in reading, but we are number one in personal lightning strikes. USA, USA. 7 times. I did that joke in Australia. Some guy in the audience was like, in a row? No. That's not a record. He wasn't just lying on the floor, just like lightning, lightning, lightning. Ow, ow, why, record.
It took 10 months to get there. And then there's other little polishes. And then a few months after that, I added another little chunk to it. So it was basically a year of working on that joke to get it to that form. And then I was doing the act more and more until it was like muscle memory. But it was every day changing little things about that joke for a year.
When you fuse in magic into stand-up, do you find that the audience reacts in a surprised way? Or do they react in a similar way to as if you are just being labeled a magician up top? Because I've noticed sometimes when you see like magic snuck into like a theatrical production or something like that, it doesn't get the reaction it would as if you tell the audience they're going to see a magic show. So I wonder how you've, if you've struggled with that or if that's something you've been conscious about.
Well, when I do the magic show, I advertise it very clearly as like, there is magic in this show. So I would hope that nobody who's walking into that show is like, why is he doing magic? Because like I have my, if I'm just doing stand-up, it'll say like Harrison Greenbaum is headlining. If I'm doing magic, it'll be like Harrison Greenbaum, what just happened, a magic and comedy show.
Gotcha.
But I also take a lot of pains to say I'm a comedian with magic as opposed to a magician with comedy, so that their expectations are in the right direction of like, the goal here is laughter and comedy, and the magic is also super awesome, but you're getting a comedian as opposed to a magician who also has jokes.
Okay.
But like it's really fun because they're laughing a lot, and so like that's sometimes the surprise is even greater because they really don't see it coming.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, if something goes wrong, they're like, yeah, he's funny. It's part of the thing is, like, it's funny that it went wrong. And then when it fixes itself, it really takes you back because you're like, oh, shit. Because also I think people don't expect the magic to be – for some, like, a lot of the compliments after shows are people are like, you were really funny, but, like, I didn't expect the magic to be as strong as it was because I work really, really hard on coming up with, like, effects that are hopefully really deceptive.
Yeah.
So that's always also really fun, is to kind of like throw people on their ass. They're like, that trick was, that was fucking impossible.
Mm-hmm.
That should not have been achievable.
Yeah.
And he did it while we were just like, he was just like making jokes.
Yeah, that's the Penn and Teller thing of, you're like, oh, I'm going to see a magic show. Oh, I didn't know I was going to see that good of a show.
Yeah.
In terms of deception, in terms of just the hours that they put into that. And I'm directing two guys in a fringe show right now, magic show, and I'm just trying to instill in them how important, like, yeah, they're doing a lot of comedy stuff and it's written as if it's a play, but like the magic that you put in has to be strong. It has to be solid, because if it's not, I think it brings the whole thing down. And to me, that's the biggest compliment people can be giving you, is, oh, we laughed a lot, but you fooled the hell out of us in a good way, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the tougher thing to do, I think.
Or even when they walk away from the show, they're just enjoying the journey. And then as they're thinking about it on the car ride home, they're just like, wait, all of those things could not have, like,
yeah,
that's fun. Cause I don't want ever, it's always frustrating when people approach it as a puzzle. Like, this is a trick I need to figure out. I'm like, I want them to be enjoying it so much that they're not worrying about how it happened.
Sure.
They're just like, whoa, that happened. That was crazy. Mm-hmm. And then, like, maybe in the car at home, they're like, oh, yeah, that there is no way. Like, how the hell did he do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard it described as driving home magic or something like that. And, yeah, I mean, that's – if somebody comes up after a show and goes, man, you fried me on that, I'm almost a little bit sad because I do want them just to have walked away and having a great time and being amazed. But, yeah, for them to take it with them and process it later – I think is a cool thing, and it is a very hard thing to achieve. It's certainly a great goal to have and keep working towards for sure. As we're coming to the end here, are there any like crazy, terrible gig stories that come to? We always like to talk to people's like great gigs. I mean, we've already talked about your great gig experiences, so let's
it's been cool.
Focus on some terrible gig experiences.
I mean, I do like 600 to 700 shows a year, so I've definitely had a tremendous amount of weird and awful gigs.
I'm trying to think, back to back, like amazing, and then immediately into a terrible set, or vice versa.
I mean, there's so many moments where, like, I remember doing the Beacon for the first time, which is 3,000 seats. It was a bucket list venue to do. It's such a New York-y venue. My parents were there, and I was like, "This is so exciting!" And then, like, the next day, I had a show where it was like, there was only 6 people in the audience in a basement. And I was just like, I was just at the Beacon. Now I'm performing for 6 people and they don't speak English. Like,
wow.
The ups and downs, like comedy is so consistently humbling.
Yeah, yeah.
Where you can do Madison Square Garden and then the next day do a bar where literally nobody was there to see comedy. So I get that a lot. Mm-hmm. I remember doing a Super Bowl. So I booked a gig, not realizing it was on the Sunday of the Super Bowl, at a youth hostel. And the only people who showed up were 2 people who didn't speak any English because they were at the hostel. They were from some like Eastern European country and had no English words. And we were doing a stand-up comedy show. There were 6 comedians, so we outnumbered the audience like 1-3. And we did the show. It was actually ended up being a really fun show. But it was just bizarre because they didn't really understand what we were doing. And like I remember like Andy Kaufmaning it and like taking them over to an arcade machine and being, I'm going to narrate this video game and like come up with jokes about this. Cause it was just something visual. Cause they couldn't really understand my words. Somebody else asked them what country they were from. And I forget which country it was, but let's say it was like Moldova or something. And so these 2 comedians like got together and just created the Moldovan national anthem. And they just sang it to them. And all the, we were just performing for each other at that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that was pretty rough. Whereas like everybody was having fun at their Super Bowl parties. And I was like, what am I, what? We're performing for 2 people who literally don't know what we're doing right now.
it's amazing. That's something I learned.
In the storage room, in the luggage storage room of a youth hostel.
It's got to be in the luggage storage room. It's got to be in the darkest room possible. Yeah, that's probably the most fascinating thing that hit me when I moved out here to LA 2.5 years ago, of just like, oh, you can just go from crazy show to very strange show back to back. And it's fine. That's just how it is. And it's incredibly humbling. And it keeps you on your toes for sure. Of, you know, what's the next thing going to be? And
you never really know which one. There's some gigs where I go, this is going to be a nightmare, and it ends up being the best. And there's some gigs where like, oh, this is just going to be such a fun, easy gig. And you get there and you're like, oh, there's literally, I mean, I remember doing a boat. It was like one of those like Manhattan cruises. So like,
oh, I've done that.
And I'd sent a whole rider, which they're not big demands, but it's just like, keep the audience near the performer. Don't put a ballroom between me and the audience.
Yep.
And I was like, I need a backup mic in case the first mic goes out, because that happens. And if that one mic goes out and we don't have a backup, then I'm just screaming. And they only had one mic, and the mic, I was like, this can't be the highest volume, right? This is like at the lowest setting. Like, no, this is as high as it goes. And it was not high enough to go over the engine. So they basically just couldn't hear me. And there was a ballroom separating me, and the Statue of Liberty kept coming up in the background. And they all kept turning around to take pictures of the Statue of Liberty in the middle of my set, which I don't blame them.
No.
But it was like that was everything that could have been against me. And I was like, all right, I still have to do this gig. I still have 45 minutes to do. But I was like, I don't think they can even hear me. Mm-hmm. Like, the front tables are somewhat getting it.
Yeah.
So I'm just screaming for 45 minutes.
I did a boat like one of those in Miami, and Ludacris was on doing a set. And he was like audibly during the set going, how many Ludacris fans we have? And everybody was like all corporate people. He's like, all right, it's going to be one of those shows. And yeah, this,
oh. And then he put his $100,000 in a duffel bag.
And then he got into a helicopter and flew away
right
from the middle of the river. Well, thank you. Thank you for doing this podcast. We already talked about lots of advice. And any parting advice before we part ways? Anything come to mind that like has stuck with you? Something that kind of always you think about? I mean, you talked about looking at the shoes before walking out on Conan. Anything that has really stuck with you over the years?
I remember asking a famous comic for advice. My first year in New York, maybe my second year in New York. And there was like a famous comic that I've always looked up to. And I was like, oh my God, sir, I'm new in this. Do you have any advice for me? And he just goes, don't suck. And that's kind of the best advice.
Sure.
Like, don't suck. Like, if you're going to do this as your job or even as your hobby, but like, if you're going to devote serious time to any kind of art form, the least you can do is not suck at it.
Yeah.
Like, do it properly or don't do it. Mm-hmm. But like, just don't suck. Like, it's such good advice.
Well, that goes back to Steve Martin. Somebody asked him, would you have any advice for being successful? Or something along those lines. And he's like, I thought the goal was to be really, really good.
Right. He also said be undeniable, which is similar too.
Good, yeah.
The only way to be successful is to be just so good that nobody can say you're not.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's like taking the don't suck as far as it can go.
Totally.
Not only don't suck, but be so good that people know you don't suck no matter who they are.
Awesome. Cool, man. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah. And if people want to follow me on HarrisonGreenbaum.com.
I'm going to put up the link to your Conan set and I'll probably even splice some of it in here because you mentioned a bit. So I'll try to do that as well.
Cool. But yeah, I'm on Twitter and Instagram. It's at Harrison Comedy. And my website is HarrisonGreenbaum.com, which has all my tour dates and that stuff.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool, man. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Two Magicians One Mic. If you would like to be a producer and support the show with a small donation, you can do so on the website twomagiciansonemic.com. And please take 30 seconds to give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Have a great day.